Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome to The Critic podcast, another of our election specials. I'm joined this week by Harrison Pitt, a senior editor at the European Conservative and a political commentator at the New Culture Forum, and also by Sam Bidwell, director of the Next Generation Centre at the Adam Smith Institute and a regular Critic contributor. Today we're going to be talking populism, from Reform to National Rally. We're also going to be catching up on the first multi-party debate here in Britain and in the EU elections on the continent. Thank you both for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you, Sebastian.
Likewise, pleasure, Sebastian.
Right, so as we're currently recording, I regret to say on a sunny Sunday afternoon, I'm all stuck inside, on the final day of the EU elections, Europe is going to the polls to elect a new parliament. Now, these are expected, I believe, to be one of the most populist elections on record in the EU, with parties of the nationalist right leading across the continent, the biggest gains expected for the Identity and Democracy group, the nationalist right grouping in the EU Parliament. So have we all been following the events, Harrison, here there in the European Conservative, living up to the name?
Yes, a bit. So obviously slightly snowballed by the fact that we've got our own election coming up, which is rather redirected attention, particularly given that I'm one of the the few among our number at the European Conservative to be based in England rather than on the continent. But I've still been paying attention, been speaking to people who I know who are much closer to the ground there, and they do expect there to be precisely this kind of right-wing nationalist wave across the continent. The only disagreement you're likely to encounter among people who would welcome such a wave is whether it's going to be significant or not in terms of affecting the direction of travel of the European Union, because the European Union, if we consider it as a kind of a ship of state of its own, it's a ship of state which is not only very cumbersome and which has a sort of pre-built an inbuilt direction which is sort of programmed into its travel, so it's very hard to redirect its course, particularly given the fact that the Commission is much more powerful than the Parliament. So I think the question is going to be A, whether this right-wing wave takes place, and B, whether the respective parties who stand to gain in their respective countries can organise effectively in the Parliament, not to completely redeem the EU, that seems unlikely to happen anytime soon, but to avert too much in the way of diluting of national sovereignty and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I mean, we'll get more on to how likely they're able to turn around the shit that is the EU. But one thing I'm interested in is, why is this happening now? You know, what's driving this surge on the right? Is this and is it the same thing that's and is it something that's just a European phenomenon, or could it happen in Britain?
If that's to me, I will say that I think that there are two. The primary driver, and it's also going to be a huge driver in our own election, is the mass demographic transformation of the countries, of the peoples of Europe, and the feeling that is felt almost across the board. I've seen some astonishing graphics testifying to this. The fact that, you know, in spite of the fact that not only do people never expressed an interest in having their own societies balkanized having a sort of a complete demographic revolution imposed on them from on high, they've consistently voted against such things. They've consistently voiced their discontent at the effects it's having on social cohesion, the effects it's having on their ability to articulate what it means to be a member of that country, because you have to dilute your understanding of Britishness or Frenchness or Germanness in order to seem inclusive when you embrace people from all over the world. And the fact that EU elites in Brussels have no time for this sort of discontent, they scoff at it from on high. And the people of Europe are rightly infuriated about this. And obviously when it manifests in the most violent fashion, it becomes particularly salient in politics. And I think it's significant that in the space of 3 weeks, we've seen three separate acts of violence by migrants in Germany, directed against the AfD, and rather than this provoking a real self-examination among the liberal media in that country, and indeed in our own country, when people outlets like Sky News report on it, some of the headlines have been, you know, cravenly ambiguous. To look at some BBC headlines and some Sky News headlines, you might have thought that it was the far right, so-called, in scare quotes, that was perpetrating these acts of violence, whereas, of course, they are the victims of them, or at least have been in Germany. And so I think that is the main driver of discontent on the continent, and the main reason why people feel a need to send an incredibly potent message to the liberal elites that reside in Brussels is immigration. And then there are also the secondary concerns about what a Green New Deal in the European Union might augur for the continent as well. You have the farmers' protests. I regard these as sort of subsidiary grievances which feed into the main one, which is demographic.
Yeah, and I mean, on the demographic thing, just a sort of sense of the data for people who are wondering what that's about. You know, I think the share of people who are either born overseas or have a foreign-born parent in Switzerland is getting up to something like 47%. I think 31% in Sweden, you know, and nearly a quarter in the UK. You know, that's a huge share of the young population that is, you know, either coming from overseas or have parents who are born from overseas, you know. And whatever you want to say about that, that is an extraordinary, unprecedented social change. You know, we're talking about countries, in many cases, where migration has not been a feature on any scale for sometimes centuries, sometimes for millennia. We're seeing Europe, and I mean, certainly in Britain, you know, I think there was almost more furious coverage of migration during the EU than there has been after it, even though migration has actually gone up. So Sam, what do you make of that?
Yes, I think it's impossible to understand what will be the probable result of the European elections without understanding the I word, that being immigration. As you say, these are seismic shifts taking place within Europe. And I think what is interesting is the demographic change runs concurrently with an economic set of circumstances in which Europe is in decline, or is at very least stagnating, has been in decline or stagnation for 15 or 20 years, in many cases since the 2008 financial crash, which many people regard as the catalyst. What you have, therefore, is a situation in which Europeans are facing both crumbling public services, an economy that isn't working for them, inability of young people to get on the housing ladder, so enormous frustration with the status quo. And at the same time, they're seeing an enormous cultural shift in which, as you say, the national languages of any given European country are no longer spoken on every street in the capital city. Often, you know, schools, you're seeing 30%, 40% of children speaking a different language. You're seeing, as I wrote about last night on Twitter, you're seeing the emergence of parallel structures of policing and courts and education for religious minorities. All of this contributes to all the sense amongst many, many Europeans that the countries that they grew up in no longer exist. And to some extent, this is a cry for help, for political action. Whether or not we think this will be an effective cry is a different question. But I think what is interesting, on top of all of that, you know, we know the populist right is going to do very well. We know that it's because of economic stagnation and immigration. What we will also see, regardless of what happens with the nationalist right, is a shrinking, relatively speaking, of the liberal and left groups within the European Parliament. So it won't just be the ID and ECR groups that do well. Actually, the EPP group, the sort of traditional centre-centre-right group, is looking to do pretty well. And you're looking down the barrel of a situation in which 55 or 60% of Europeans go out and vote for a party of the centre-right or right, which is an enormous shift from a continent that has traditionally regarded itself as the home of social democracy or of traditional electoral liberalism. What we've seen, what we will see, I suspect, is a refusal, a reputation of those ideas, of those ideologies, in favour certainly of conservatism in one form or another, and in a great many cases of a more radical nationalist populist conservatism.
And of course, as it was in Britain before Brexit, I think votes for the EU Parliament are seen as a place to lodge a protest vote because, you know, these people are not going to be governing your country, but it is an opportunity to sort of say, you know, screw you to the people in Brussels and to send a message to your own country's politicians. So it is possibly easier for populist parties to do well in them than in national elections in some cases.
Well, what I would say there is there's a countervailing trend as well, which is that voters of populist parties tend to think that the EU Parliament isn't worth bothering with. So there was a bit of early election data out of the Netherlands, which is probably the European country that I know best and have written on before for The Critic, where voters that supported at the recent general election there supported the Green and Labour Party joint group. Those voters turned out, about 65, 70% of them turned out to vote in the EU Parliament, whereas only about 25 or 30% of the voters who backed Geert Wilders' PVV, the nationalist Islamoskeptic right-wing populist party there, only about 25 or 30% of those voters turned out because they see the EU Parliament as illegitimate. They see it as a talking shop, a waste of time. They're far more concerned about their own national parliament. So on the one hand, you have this kind of send a message instinct amongst voters. A lot of voters will go, well, this is a great chance to give the establishment a kicking without necessarily having to bear the same consequences as at a national election. But you also have the fact that nationalist voters inclined to the right, are likely to view the EU Parliament as little more than a bureaucratic talking shop.
That's an interesting question. I wonder, and this is a question for either of you, do you think there's do you think there is much prospects of this changing the parliament? Are the populist voters right? Is this just gonna is the EU parliament just a talking shop?
I think it is primarily a talking shop. Given the fact that, as I understand it, the EU constitution only the only real significance that the parliament has is vetoing legislation potentially and voting upon legislation. So there's unlike in the British Parliament where there is a right, provided the leader of the House needs to make room for it. You can't just be introducing bills willy-nilly, but private members can in fact initiate legislation, and that there have been very significant legislative achievements, if you want to call them that, or legislative calamities, if you don't like them, which have actually begun as private members' bills. There's no understand the ID block or the ECR block would not, even in incredibly large numbers, be able to drive the agenda of the parliament. That would be dictated from on high. They would just have a certain amount of influence in shaping and responding to those di dictates, which come primarily from the commission. And the commission is going to be always, frankly, unless there is just a complete sort of revolution at a kind of spiritual level among the people who really matter in Brussels, it is all and a kind of a complete, seismic shift in the understanding of what Brussels is for. And you will meet some people on the right who are actually very keen to use the administrative state of the EU, considered as a kind of administrative state, to advance a sort of populist agenda. But that's a decades-long project, potentially changing the minds of the people who really matter in Brussels. And it's not going to happen just because, France and the Netherlands and Hungary and all of these other countries are voicing their discontent at this level. And there is precisely that countervailing tendency that Sam just spoke about there. It didn't tend to obtain too much in Britain. That might be one thing to say. I mean, the 2013 and the 2019 European elections, I mean, I'm not going to pretend that turnout was at 95%. It wasn't. It was probably about 40% or 45%. I can't recall from memory. Particularly in 2019, it was quite high, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's a lot of European countries, it's sort of around 20% or something.
Exactly,
It really sounds like it's, and I
yes.
think part of that is the fact that in an awful lot of European countries have something like a single transferable vote or proportional representation as part of their voting systems. Britain doesn't. So
Yes.
the EU elections was kind of the only sort of, well, I mean, obviously, this is Scottish Parliament of things, in the level of a national election, the only place you could go is the EU. And now, of course, that's gone. And we've got reform trying to get into the Westminster system, which we're going to get onto later. So I won't get to that much now. But and I thought it was interesting.
Well, I would actually just add,
Yeah,
there
go
is
on.
one very good reason to go out and elect a nationalist MEP, and that's resources. So we just mentioned the Britain's EU elections. Now, what UKIP's successes in 2014 and 2000, well, and then latterly the Brexit Party in 2019 did, was equip a number of senior figures within UKIP and within the Brexit Party with a fabulous salary and a huge staff, which they could turn towards their own political ends. So, you know, Farage, dogged though he is, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot about him later on, is nothing without the resources and the platform and the staffers and, you know, the kind of people to do the administrative work. He's not a man, I gather, who's terribly fond of sorting out his own inbox. So it's important to have staff and salary and resources. And the European Parliament is a great way for nationalists to siphon off some of the Commission's enormous bureaucratic resource towards their own ends. So if you're a party like, you know, Vox in Spain or like Fratelli d'Italia in Italy, you look at this and you say, well, this is a fabulous way to get more of our people in a position where they've got a bit of money behind them, they've got an in with the media, because you go from being a senior figure within a political party to being an elected MEP with a mandate. That gives you more opportunity to talk about things on through traditional media routes. It gives you a greater platform. It gives you more money, and it also gives you a team around you who can support your endeavours. So there's a very good practical reason. And I wonder, and I'm sure, again, we'll come on to this later, I wonder whether that will be a stumbling block for reform, which will be the lack of a platform from which to project outside of national elections.
And presumably also, even if they can't propose the kind of policy they want in the European Parliament, they can probably frustrate a lot of policy that their opponents would want.
Yes, and certainly they can talk about it. You know, as we've seen, more oxygen for parties of the nationalist right tends to translate into more votes. And so opportunities to stand up in the Commission, or stand up in the Parliament and bash whatever nonsense the Commission is trying to put through will be very, very welcome for lots of these up-and-coming nationalists.
So we've talked a bit about the right and the populist right, but I'm interested in what the perspective of the left is here. So obviously, some of the things we're talking about here, the things that are driving the sense of the cultural and the demographic and the social change that is creating a conservative resistance in Europe, it does feel very violently polarized. There's one people think that, you know, European civilization is under siege. That's perspective of people on the populist right. Then you have a large number of people on the liberal left who think that, you know, fascism is on the rise because people don't want open borders. They think, you know, I mean, maybe I'm paradigm position here somewhat, but they would say that European birth rate's going down. The European economies are slowing. We need new young workers to come and support us, and you know, why would you oppose this except for reasons of racism? That would be so. I mean, what do you think that there's so little kind of middle ground? I mean, I'm struck by the fact that historically, you know, parties of the left were more Eurosceptic, they were more skeptical of free trade and free movement of labor precisely because they were strongly rooted in union movements. What's changed, and why is the argument so divided?
I think it has a huge amount to do with the fact that the left itself, and I know at the moment it might seem from a British perspective that the right is in greater crisis if we consider the Conservative Party right wing in any meaningful sense, then the left is, you know, debatable. And in fact, not debatable, they're not. But the left is I think the mid-20th century left had its, you know, crusades, it had its talking points, it had it, and it was rooted in a certain amount of, you know, they talk about Christian social democracy. I think it was Tony Benn who would say that the Labour Party owes a great deal more to the teachings of Christ than it does to the ramblings of Karl Marx. I think that's an actual quote from Tony Benn once. And so the left believed in these sorts of, I suppose, Christian social values and solidarity not being the least among them, and this made sense in that context. Whereas today, given that the left has completely swallowed hook, line, and sinker the the tripartite motto of race, communists, the world over, diversity, equity, and inclusion, it's much more interested in the politics of racial grievance than it is with showing solidarity with the working man. as a result of that shift that's happened, and it's largely owing to demographics that it has happened, the left has felt the need to pivot away from the native or indigenous working classes of their respective countries and agitating for their interests for the, against the interests of capital in the name of social solidarity, precisely because that just isn't as much of a winning argument as it used to be among that demographic. And the concerns of today are very different from the concerns when Michael Foot was leading the Labour Party in the early 1980s. The left has had to pivot away from that tradition while nevertheless borrowing some of the language at an abstract level, at least, and while gnawing away at the foundations which made that world of, you know, sort of working class patriotic solidarity possible in the first place. And the perfect person who embodies this crisis would be someone like Owen Jones. And he, of course, has his correlates and his analogues on the continent as well. And so I think the left is just far less. Yes, of course, there are concerns about, we saw it a bit with Occupy Wall Street in the United States. There is a left wing version of populism, which became popular in the aftermath of the financial crisis, and which was you know, pitted itself against the perceived corporate gigantism that dominates so much of the modern world, but in the context of a complete demographic transformation imposed on the peoples of Europe without their consent, that the native populations despise and the left supports in the name of anti-racism and averting the arrival of some kind of fourth right, that is just that has plunged the left into an identity crisis, which I think makes it far less well positioned to take advantage of all the populist energy that is around. There are exceptions. You have people who are genuine left-wing populists who don't swallow the DEI crusade hook, line, and sinker. And a good example would be someone like William Clouston in Britain. I'm less aware of these people on the continent if they exist, which I'm sure they do.
I was going to say one of the exceptions to the sort of besiegement of the left in the European Parliament is Denmark, where the Social Democratic Party is expected to do well in these elections. And of course, Denmark is more or less seen off its right wing populist by stealing some of their clips. So the left wing party there has taken a tough line on immigration, and it seems to have worked. I mean, I don't know what you make of that, Sam. If you think there's a path back for the left, you could just have social democracy with low immigration. You'd have to have the fourth Reich. What do you reckon, Sam?
Well, this is the great challenge. So, as you say, in Denmark, the Social Democrats have been very successful at aping some of the language and actually putting into practice some of the ideas of the national populists. But you also see it in Germany. So, you know, Sarah Wagenknecht has just launched her own new party, which is would identify itself as economically left-wing and culturally conservative, certainly very critical of German orthodoxy around migration. I think the challenge is, as Harrison put it, that the structures that created 20th century social democracy in Europe have pretty much disintegrated. So you've seen widespread secularism on the continent. You've seen broadly, outside of a few examples, deindustrialization across much of the continent. So even in markets like Germany, where the industrial capacity is still far greater than it is in a country like Britain, you've still seen a relative offshoring of that country's industrial capacity. You see fewer people working in traditional industrial jobs. And so the struggles that once existed, where you had an identifiable working class which tended to be culturally conservative, those struggles have passed by. And certainly in the 1990s, there was this sort of Damascene conversion to liberalism amongst much of the social democratic political class. Now, the question is whether or not there are enough people remnant in these parties, or enough people intellectually malleable enough within these parties to make the switch back, to say, actually, we took on liberalism in the 1990s. It seemed like in the wake of the Cold War, Fukuyama's end of history, we were all going liberal in one way or another. Actually, the global reality is no longer this way. The question is whether there are enough of these people left inside the left in Europe to make that change. And my suspicion would be, outside of a few cases, that the answer is probably not. If you talk to the kind of person who would traditionally have gone on to join the Labour Party in, say, the Netherlands or the French Parti Socialiste. That sort of young person no longer gravitates towards the centre-left. In fact, they often, you know, they will accuse the centre-left of either being too radical in its insistence upon DEI or not radical enough in its lack of insistence on DEI. So the space that once existed for culturally conservative social democrats, I fear, has largely disappeared, partly because of policies that social democrats pursued in the 1990s and early 2000s. The economic model is different, the cultural context is different, and I think trying to reheat the political assumptions of the mid-20th century will be very, very difficult for a movement that in much of the continent is, as Harrison rightly notes, is in crisis.
Yeah, and I mean, just on this question of crisis, it does feel like this is not politics as usual, not even of a radical kind. I mean, this is also, if it's been one of the most populist elections, it's also been some of the most violent. So there have been surprising amount of political violence in the run-up to his election. So there have been two stabbings in Germany, both political, both targeted on right-wing protests, one of an AfD candidate. There was an attempted assassination of the Slovakian prime minister. There was a violent attack on the Danish prime minister. There was an attack on another, I think, AfD candidate with baseball bats. There was someone who tried to beat up a social democrat in Germany. This is, you know, it's a level of social kind of disorder and violence that we're not used to seeing in elections, let alone EU elections. I don't know if either of you have a theory as to why we've seen so much of this and, you know, why some of the rhetoric has been so heightened.
I'm happy to jump in. I will actually shamelessly plug a bit of work that I'm doing. In about 2 weeks' time, with the Henry Jackson Society on precisely this question about mounting political violence across the Western world. I think it's always useful to contextualize where Europe is on the question of political violence, in that until very recently, Europe was basically the exception to the global rule, which is that politicians have to be kept away from the public, highly securitized. They have to be constantly monitored by the state to make sure that nobody tries to attack them or kill them. In large parts of the world, this is now the norm, and the political class stays sheltered away. We've been very lucky in Europe for, you know, at least 100 years to have a high trust society in which politicians could be trusted to walk the streets, could meet with ordinary voters, could engage as individuals rather than just as spokespeople for a political party or a political movement. Partly because of, in large part because of the decisions and actions of those politicians, that high trust society is now totally eroded. And Europe, in its great exceptionalism, is starting to slide towards the kind of political norms that you see elsewhere in the world. This is very, very scary for those of us who have only ever known a European political context, because what it will mean is less direct access to politicians. It will mean a political culture of tit-for-tat political violence. All of these things have a chilling effect on the willingness of politicians to speak openly about certain issues, though particularly where a nationalist politician is attacked by somebody who accuses them of racism, you know, expect to see quiet, mealy-mouthed centre-right politicians shy away from those kinds of issues for fear of reprisal. The question of why is basically one of changing cultural context and conditions again. So we in Europe now have less to agree on than we used to. 40 years ago, 50 years ago, for all sorts of reasons, your European centre-left voter and your European centre-right voter shared far more cultural touchstones. They shared far more economic, social, religious interests than they do now. There's less in common. And at the same time, political systems have failed to deliver the kind of change that voters have consistently voted for. So it's not difficult to see why a voter who looks at Europe over the last 40 years decides that democracy doesn't work and interprets all of those signs and says, well, actually, you know, the best way to achieve change is going to be to take direct action and to intimidate or threaten or attack a politician. It's scary, but this is the logical conclusion of failure to meet people's needs through politics.
I agree with everything Sam just said there, but I will also add that I think that the perceived reluctance of the state, fundamentally, and law enforcement authorities to step in at times when maybe, you know, protesters, whether it's sort of the BLM riots of and protests of 2020, or more recently the anti-Israel, pro-Palestine protests that have greeted London every week, the perceived reluctance of the police to get involved too heavily when those sorts of, not so much attacks on limb, so much as attacks on property are taking place, whether it's people swarming one of our finest monuments in London, or whether it's people taking down the Colston statue, the perceived impotence of the authorities in response to these acts of political agitation emboldens certain people who feel as though their own the inherent righteousness of their own moral crusades trumps the importance of law. I think that has an incredibly negative effect on it. Completely coarsens our not only our political discourse, but also makes political violence much more likely, because there's an understanding that it's not going to be met with head on with the full force of the law. Because if when Colston statues tumbled in Bristol, people get off lightly. You know, the incentive is to escalate and go a little further. And the second thing I would say as well is that we would all of us readily grant that while people aren't reducible, individuals are not reducible to the national context in which they live. The national context in which people live and grow up, and the attitudes and the habits and the achievements and indeed the defects which are common there, once you take a given group of those people and bring them into a new national context, they don't immediately shed all of their prior attachments. So for example, we would all readily grant, given the high educational achievement that people in, say, Japan have, or the people in China or in South Korea have, that if you take a randomized sample of hundreds of thousands of South Koreans and bring them into Britain, that will have an incredibly qualitatively measurable impact on educational achievement in Britain, because those habits will be, so to speak, part of a cultural transplant. And it, unfortunately, it also applies the other way. If you're importing loads of people from scenarios where political violence is much more common, tribal violence is much more common, you can expect the same thing to happen. And there's a great book on this by Garrett Jones called The Culture Transplant, which goes into the fact that when you bring immigrants from all over the world into a settled national context, they bring not only certain attitudes along with them, but certain habits along with them as well. And it's naive to think that the sheer existence of a different legal framework, or the sheer existence of a different habits among the native population is going to change, is going to affect a sort of a massive transformation. Like, you know, Gatwick and Heathrow, these are not magic liberal making pacifying portals, and it's
quite
naive
the
to
opposite.
Think that they are.
I've rarely passed for a British airport without losing all attachment to liberal democracy.
Indeed,
off you, it just sweeps away. But I mean, I'm interested. I mean, as well as the sort of as demographic influence, I'm also struck by the sense of America. You know, America sneezes, we all catch a cold. So obviously the sense of, you know, politics becoming more violent, and also of things like courts being politicized, it's, you know, this sense of like politicization of public, it does feel very American, and it feels like we're always 5 years behind whatever America's doing.
I think there's certainly a measure of that, and certainly we were talking before about why the European left has transfigured in the way that it has, and I think you can credit that shift in large part to greater cultural ties with America. There's certainly a link there. I mean, I know the British context on courts better than I know the European context on courts, and you know, amusingly, I would actually say that we are quiet trailblazers as regard politicization of the courts. We've been doing it for much longer than the Americans, like it or not. Even if they have political appointees, we have something even worse, which is political bureaucrats. So
Is it a league of its own?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you need only look at the Anna's Minnick decision of 1968 to discover how willing British courts have been to be political very early on. But I will take your question in its face rather than going on about 20th century jurisprudence, which, you know, is not necessarily the appropriate forum.
That's good.
Yeah, of course, there's a link to America in terms of the trends that we're now seeing. Of course, there's a bit of give and take. And I would suggest that is something that's liable to change in the next 15 to 20 years. So we've already seen over, for example, the presence of the Houthis in the Red Sea or approaches to China, deviations between a European position and the American position. So what was once assumed to be this kind of Euro-Atlantic pact that was unbreakable and which upheld liberal democracy worldwide, very much now fallen down. Europe's willingness to follow along with the Anglo-American line on foreign policy has frayed, to say the least, over the last 15 to 20 years, and I think will continue to fray as new economic and political realities take shape. So what I expect that we'll see is actually I wouldn't be surprised if in 15 or 20 years, European populist nationalist parties are taking a slightly more skeptical line on America again. The difference now in this particular moment is the big orange elephant in the room, which is Donald Trump. And it's impossible to ignore the fact that Trump has consciously portrayed himself as the leader of the global nationalist movement. He hobnobs around with people like Orban and he praises Mr. Brexit in Britain. And, you know, he has his whole kind of shtick where he's the leader of Western nationalism. When he disappears as a figure, I wouldn't be surprised if some of that phenomena whereby America is culturally upstream from Europe and certainly politically upstream from Europe, I wouldn't be surprised if that disappears a little, because what we're actually seeing is that America and Europe have increasingly different interests, and the American proxy, as the French would see us in Europe, the role that Britain once played as an American proxy in Europe, has to a large extent disintegrated following our departure from the European Union. So that very ostentatiously Anglo-Saxon influence on European affairs and being gone, I wouldn't be surprised if we see a bit more of the kind of Yankee go home instinct that once dominated on the French left and indeed on the French right.
So before we go, before we start chasing away across the Atlantic and diverting the podcast completely, I have to sadly force you both to talk about the British election, which is still ongoing. Who knew? But I don't know if either of you are unfortunate enough to, or your editor forced you to, or your boss forced you to watch Friday's multi-party debate.
Unfortunately, yes.
Poor souls that we are. Harrison?
Yes, yeah, no, it was an immensely traumatic experience, obviously. Occasionally gingered up by Farage's contributions, which I did find, you know, energizing in large part, although I do have criticisms of Farage. I'm sick to death of the net zero line, frankly, on immigration. I think that's a very corny, boomer-friendly construct, which is designed to please people on Facebook by analogy with of course Boris Johnson's net zero policy on green matters. I think it's a very corny line which needs to be ditched, not just because it's corny, but because it's frankly incoherent. I do also think that with reform, if I might continue the criticisms, I think there is far too much of a tendency on their part. I'm slightly sympathetic to Peter Hitchens's characterization of them as a sort of Thatcher tribute band. And I do think that they are themselves awkwardly placed in terms of an identity crisis, in that clearly Farage, I do think that at heart, he is genuinely a British patriot who cares, who believes that whatever economic liberalism he subscribes to, and, you know, all countries need a certain amount of economic liberalism. I'm sure Sam, as a member of the Adam Smith Institute, will certainly agree with that. The question for me, as someone who cares about you know, locality, and who cares about neighborhood, and who cares about nationhood, and cares about identity as well, is when you encounter economic liberals, what is your economic liberalism constrained by? At what point are you willing to step in because you realize that there is a greater interest which cannot be denominated in monetary terms? And I think that Farage is a patriot in that sense, but I do think that he has a tendency, given that Thatcherite background, and Richard Tice is obviously very implicated in this as well, to obsess a little bit too much over economics. And the fact is that this whole net zero line, net immigration is only really makes sense in the context of planning for population expansion. It's a sort of logistical way of thinking about immigration. You know, what kind of plans do we need to make vis-a-vis housing? Who's going to be making a net fiscal contribution? And these are all legitimate concerns which can be, so to speak, tabulated on a spreadsheet. But what the net migration metric doesn't take sufficient account of is the cultural churn that goes on at the border. And I don't view it as being a like-for-like swap. I don't think that human beings are these, you know, fungible, undifferentiated entities who can just be tabulated on a spreadsheet. What also matters is the churn, who is leaving and who is arriving. And so on Farage's one in, one out line, I think it was originally Tice's, but Farage has embraced it. On that one in, one out formula, you could have 500,000 really enterprising young British people with an ancestral connection to this country and an instinctive loyalty to it, in theory, or in principle at least, replaced by people who have no such attachment at all. And so the cultural aspect gets lost when we focus too much on these logistical angles. And I think that that's also a downfall in reforms rhetoric, which needs to be redressed pretty soon, as far as I'm concerned.
Hesitant though I am to accuse reform of political correctness, it does feel, I think the economic line does feel like a lot safer way of expressing skepticism about immigration. Like, no one's going to, like, people might disagree with you factually, but no one is going to, well, maybe some people will call you a bigot for worrying about whether there'll be enough hospitals, but it's a lot easier, you know, it's a lot easier in a in the pub and family discussion in your workplace to say, well, I of course have no problem with people coming to this country, but I'm worried about, are there going to be enough school places? Is my house price going to go up or down?
You know, indeed.
And you know, there's a valid concerns we should talk about, but the sense of like, well, who we are ought to be a legitimate conversation. And it isn't to say people can't come and become British, but the sense is, do they want to become British? I mean, this would be a question, like, should we even expect people to become British? I mean, much as we all enjoy it, it's not for everyone. And, you know, there's a simple answer is, if you want to come to Britain to work, but you don't want to become British, then maybe you should be a guest worker rather than, you know, living here for generations. It's again, that ought to be, I feel like, a common sense thing we should be able to talk about. But I certainly, on the evidence of Friday's debate, it still, despite everything that's happened, despite all of the political ructions, it still feels we're still talking in euphemisms. And I don't know for anyone.
I would just insert one point here, and I think this is another way in which our discourse has been subtly Americanized, because it's not just the fact that the State Department has an interest. This is what Sam was touching upon earlier, the way in which many Europeans are annoyed at what they perceive to be a pernicious American influence on their continent, and sort of Nord Stream obviously regularly comes up in this respect. It's not just the State Department's foreign policy interest which gripes many Europeans. It's also the Americanization of our discourse. I think that, and obviously countries with strong English, countries which have high levels of English speaking people in them are going to be more susceptible to that, of course. I think it's also the way our discourse has been Americanized. And I think the very idea of talking about Britishness as though it's a set of propositional axioms into which you can opt, this kind of civic nationalist language, you know, the David Cameron sort of, here are the 10 values that make you British, and if you opt into these, you become part of us. I think that that's a very mistaken, I think that's a very American way of understanding national identity, and I don't think that propositional nationalism of that kind is going to be of much service to us, particularly if our own values are themselves being diluted. But I think of a country as an organism which is itself subject to shifts in its collective values, and as far as I'm concerned, there is no such thing as Britishness abstractly defined. And an example I like to give here is that if you kind of wheel out someone like David Cameron and you say, What are British values? And Cameron comes along and says, well, multiculturalism, democracy, tolerance, and, you know, being nice to people. But just take two of those, democracy and toleration. You know, it's plausible that there are people living in, say, Nigeria today who believe at an abstract propositional level in both tolerance and in democracy. But I don't think that necessarily makes them British. And if it did, it would make them more British than someone like Lord Bolingbroke living in the 18th century who didn't really believe in any of those things. I think that our nations are themselves projects which have much more to do with history and peoplehood than they have to do with values that you were sent to, because of course those will change from generation to generation. So for me, the ultimate test, the ultimate litmus test for someone coming into Britain and is truly assimilating here would be that they intermarry to a point where they become indistinguishable from the host population. And the archetypal example here, or an archetypal example, would be the Huguenots. I mean, no one actually knows where the Huguenot community is today. No one says, well, we want more Huguenots on, you know, this awards list. We want more Huguenots in the NHS, working in the NHS.
I mean, there are people currently, you know, no doubt running for the goddess, my great 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 grandfather was a Huguenot, and therefore there is no such thing as Britishness. So,
well, of course there are.
But that's a ticking time bomb.
That is an esoteric interest.
They were just waiting,
Sebastian, as you know, and it is there, but it just doesn't ring true at all. And so for me, becoming British would be to intermarry with someone who is themselves an indigenous member of the population, such that your children become indistinguishable from the host population. And that's what happens with that the true test of assimilation is that you don't notice them anymore.
But yes, back on the debate, Sam, did you think there was a winner? Can there even be a winner? Does anyone care about these things anymore?
Well, you know, there was an England game on, so let's not kid ourselves as to how much interest there was in real terms in this debate. I will hop quickly onto the points made about Farage's presentation around nationalism and identity, and then I'll give a bit of sober, I hope sober, political analysis. I think that point about British values is absolutely salient. So when you can find 18th or 19th century writings about British values, but what people are doing is rather than seeking to prescribe, they are describing the observed habits of a political community. So, you know, Burke or somebody like him would very well say, well, actually, you know, the British temperament is one of careful conservative reform. And actually, you know, we can define ourselves in opposition to those terrible Napoleonic French who are dreadful and radical. And I know, you know, Sebastian, this is exactly up your street. But that was a descriptive exercise rather than a prescriptive exercise. And it wasn't presumed in any of that by sharing those views, one could become British, right? So what I think is interesting when we talk about this question of values-based nationalism is the question then, well, why were so many people upset by Rishi Sunak's decision to leave the D-Day event early? And I think in many ways, this plays an interesting proxy role. So if integration in the minds of most British people is simply about earning lots of money and obeying the rules and being broadly liberal and tolerant, then why should we care at all whether or not somebody is interested in D-Day? Right? Because it actually isn't about that. What this whole debacle around D-Day actually reveals is that people feel that nationhood is to some extent historical and cultural. And, you know, one must be able to imagine their ancestors storming the beach in Normandy or being on either side of the battle in 1066 or, you know, tilling some field in Lincolnshire in 1250. You know, there is a sense that to be properly British, one must identify with British history. And so people rankle at anything which seems like a rejection or a repudiation of the national history. So that's... I'll park that conversation there. We could be going all day about that. As regards who won the debate, I think all of these debates are an exercise in talking past one another. So there were multiple conversations going on. There was the Farage v. everyone else conversation. There was the Labour v. Conservative conversation. And then there was the sort of mass third party midwittery of the other contestants. I think there's a slight farce in inviting along Plaid Cymru and the SNP to what is allegedly a national debate. And I say this as a Welshman myself for my sins. So let this not be called Anglo supremacy. I'm in fact objecting to the decision to invite a party to a debate when it wins about 20% of the vote in the third largest constituent nation in the country. That seems a little farcical. If there is a winner, it was Farage, because all of his priors were confirmed by the debate. Nobody was willing to engage him in reasonable debate on immigration. He was broadly left to the wayside of the kind of love-in that happened at the end of the debate, where all the contestants go and hug one another and, you know, shake hands and take selfies and all of this stuff. In being ostracized from all of that, his point was exactly proven, which
he's
is that
rebel.
This is a... He's the rebel, exactly. And, you know, as anybody with any knowledge of history knows, the best way to blunt a rebel is to bring them into the tent and make them feel like they're part of the establishment. And in either ignoring him or battling him in the way that they did, the other parties did precisely the opposite, and they gave absolute credence to his views, his view of himself as this kind of tearaway anti-establishment figure. The best thing to do, of course, would have been to gently agree with him. That would have taken much of the wind out of his sails. But you know, as this election campaign has demonstrated, our political establishment is not terribly good at dealing with a figure like Nigel Farage.
Mm. I mean, we talk about our electoral establishment. I mean, you know, we have some polls showing Reform within a few points, the Conservative Party. Nigel Farage says he wants to destroy the Conservative Party. But of course, it's incredibly hard in first past the post system for a third party to go over that tipping point and start winning a substantial number of seats. Because generally speaking, Reform support is broad but shallow. It doesn't have a commanding majority, except of potentially a few seats. Like obviously, Clacton, that Farage is contesting, they may get two or three more other seats, but no more. And that will be despite potentially winning 15-16% of the vote. There will be parties that will be getting less of the vote but getting more seats. I wonder whether you think that's something that the party will be able to overcome in the long run, whether they could even displace the Tories. I mean, that's obviously what they'd like to do, but is there any chance of that?
I don't want to predict an unlikely surge in the next 4 weeks.
No, hardly in the next four weeks.
Yes, but one thing that can happen first past the post, of course, you're right that there is a huge mismatch fundamentally between the amounts of votes you're able to garner in the country as a whole and the amount of seats you are able to achieve at Westminster. And many people perceive that rightly as not just unjust to those parties, but as unjust to the people who voted for them, presumably because they wanted to change the political dispensation at Westminster, and then they didn't do that in a supposedly representative democracy. So there is that grievance there. But one of the advantages of first past the post is that it is highly, the way in which people vote in that system, the incentive structure is such that perception of credibility of either power or being in opposition can have a seismic effect. And what you can get, let's say that the Reform were to draw not only level with the Conservatives in polling, but were to actually overtake them, then in the public mind, at least, the Reform wouldn't be perceived any longer, as UKIP was in 2015, as a rather impotent but nevertheless satisfying protest vote, but actually as a credible party, probably not of government in this case, but in a, at any rate of opposition, or angling to be, as Farage says, the opposition, true opposition as opposed to formal opposition. And what you could get is what sort of psychologists call a preference cascade, where votes hemorrhage from the Tories even more so in response to this this perception in the public mind. Money among donors dries up. We've already seen the Conservatives roll back their own social media platform because there's not enough money. I hear from people that morale is completely crushed and pitiful, frankly, in CCHQ. So that's one advantage of first past the post, is that things can change quite quickly when perceptions change. This, the other advantage with first past the post, and this is why I'm actually a little bit reluctant of embracing a continental model of proportional representation, even though in mathematical terms, in considering legislatures and seats and all that sort of thing, it seems more just. What actually happens is that accountability becomes even more dispersed as well. If you're dispersing the significance of voting, you're also going to be dispersing accountability. And while no system is going to be perfect and no system is going to be fit to saving a country, what you will get in Britain, I suspect, under first past the post, is a great deal more backroom dealing, which in fact dilutes what people consider themselves to be voting for in the first place. And we've seen that in we've seen that. I'll just make give two examples. Mm-hmm. We've seen that already with Giorgia Meloni in Italy. Many people are very disappointed in some of her turnarounds, particularly on immigration and the issuing of visas and all that sort of thing. And I think we're likely, Sam knows more about the Netherlands from me, but I think we're likely to see it with Geert Wilders as well, as he goes into coalition government with people who we would consider to be wets. And reform under PR would probably, even if it was a majority government of sorts, you know, it would have to have its penny mordants in the cabinet as well. And that would be deeply unsatisfactory.
Yes, I mean, I suppose there's a sort of underpass, there's a sort of threshold whereby, you know, we've seen this in the rhetoric of parties in elections. Don't vote for them, you'll get Labour. That's what they say about them. You know, that's what they're currently saying about reform. And of course, the great advantage reform has in this election is that people already have accepted that the Tories are going to lose. They're not particularly concerned. I think they could turn things around if they can get people worried about what Labour will do, but at the moment they're not very concerned that Labour's got a supermajority. So there's very little incentive for them not to vote for a third party and just lodge a protest vote. And I think there is a certain threshold whereby if you can get a certain proportion of the vote within a constituency, if you're perceived as potentially winning it, people are no longer scared of getting the other. Once people are no longer scared they're going to get a third party they don't want from voting for you, they'll stop voting for the party that they are not quite as invested in. And I think the Tories have been basically, you know, you think about all of the kind of like third parties of the left that are regular features of elections, the Lib Dems, the Greens, and of course the generally left-leaning national parties. There is no equivalent on the right, at least there hasn't been up until reform. So I think this is this is going to force, I think, the Tories to think quite differently. I mean, Sam, what do you make of it?
I think that's right. The salient election to compare this to is 2015, when UKIP won something like 13% of the vote at national level. It was, you know, they won in Clacton, they just lost in Thanet South, which is where Nigel Farage was standing in at that time. And the great line that Cameron, who for his many faults is a fairly competent political operator, if not a competent policy operator, his great coup was making the election about, well, it's either me or it's Ed Miliband and Alex Salmond, which for many English voters was a deeply unappealing prospect. Now, Rishi Sunak has to stand up and say, well, you know, it's either me or Keir Starmer, at a time when the polls are showing that Labour will win probably about 400 seats, 380, 400 seats. It's simply not a credible proposition. So Nigel Farage can stand up and say, well, OK, that's all very well, but neither of us is going to be Prime Minister, and I really mean the things I'm saying. Nor do the Conservatives have a great record to trade off. So you can't even do history. You can't go, well, Farage has got no history of delivery, when you're a party which has presided over... 1.2 million people coming in last year, 1.3 million the year before, rollout of the regulatory state on a level surpassed only by the new Labour governments of the Tony Blair years, economic stagnation, greater taxation, etc. It's very, very difficult to run on record if you're the Conservative Party in 2024. Whereas in 2015, it was a little easier. You could say, well, actually, we've started to get the deficit under control. You all remember the 2008 financial crash. You know what Labour are like. You could kind of gesture vaguely in the direction of that there is no money left note. Now, that's all very hard to do after failing to grow the economy for 14 years and making the migration problem much, much worse. There will come a point in many seats where the logical anti-Labour vote is for reform. The question is whether or not reform is able to get that information out there as effectively as it needs to. And the problem that they will have is that reform is not structured like a traditional 20th century mass mobilization political movement. It is a corporation which is designed to fight air wars and to hold rallies. And, you know, the Conservative Party, for its many, many faults, at least has a handful of geriatric activists who are still willing to go door to door and tell voters how to vote. Whereas reform has no such people's army on the doors. And so in a seat like Clacton, maybe you could see Farage picking that up off sheer strength of national vote. But in a seat like Boston and Skegness, which is where Richard Tice is standing in this election, you need a decent ground game to have a chance of telling voters we are the tactical vote here for the right, we are the sensible vote against Labour. Without that ground game, I think they're going to have a tough time. But given the way that polls are looking, given that the way that polls are trending, I wouldn't be surprised if they picked up 3 to 4 seats along what is often termed the UKIP coast. So that sort of east coast up from Kent all the way up to sort of Hartlepool.
Like the sack, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. Except the Danelaw. I wouldn't be surprised if they picked up 3 or 4 seats in the Danelaw.
All right. Well, I'm very cognizant of the fact that I'm forcing all of us to be inside on a Sunday, beautiful Sunday afternoon, at least where I'm my neck of the woods. I'll try and wrap things up, but I'll just leave one last question for both of you. We've talked about a lot of analysis, but is it a good thing, the rise of populism? And more important, and perhaps and relatedly, are they going to have an easy time of it? We're constantly hearing about how they're going to rise up against the system and solve all of the problems and stop mass migration and stop globalization. But there is a certain, we've seen with Maloney, they do struggle to do the hard work. They do seem to struggle to do the governance. Is populism good? Is populism something that is going to fall apart? Is it something that perhaps is going to kind of do its job, force more mainstream politicians to take these concerns seriously and then disappear or be folded into the mainstream? What do you both think?
Unless populism is willing to do something which doesn't come naturally to populists and relinquish its underdog status, which is a kind of exhilarating experience of being a populist, I'm railing against the establishment, I'm Caesar crossing the Rubicon, the sort of exhilaration of the protest and of negative fury. Unless it's willing to relinquish that underdog status and become, so to speak, the new elite or the new establishment, then it's going to have a very tough time of it. It may be able to make headlines during an election year, but it will lack the ambition to define a century. And of course, Caesar, not saying we need some kind of Caesaristic dictator, but yes, something like...
You've heard it on the Critic podcast first. Harrison Pitt calls for Caesarian dictators.
Not quite, but I think something like that level of ambition, because Caesar was a populist when he crossed the Rubicon, yeah. But once he won at the Battle of Thasalus, he ceased being a populist and he became a person who really mattered in Rome. And likewise, you need something like that level of political ambition. Otherwise, you're just going to be a very self-satisfied but impotent protest movement.
So, well, yes, look, I would broadly echo that. I think if I take the British example, because it's the one I know best, anybody who understands the scale of the challenge, size of the regulatory state, the size of the quangocracy, all of these sort of problematic institutional features, understand that we need a sort of Gramscian march to the institutions. And I risk, when I talk about this stuff, becoming very Maoist in my tendency, because the scale of the challenge is indeed so great. But where populist movements have succeeded, it's largely been in creating, I hesitate to endorse again a sort of Caesarian authoritarian, but where populist movements have succeeded in creating that sort of figure, the wind has come out of their sails, but also they've tended to have a pretty significant effect on the direction of nations. So, one need look at Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore, who in many ways was taking the wind out of ethnic resentment among the Han Chinese. You can look at Ataturk in Turkey, who in many ways was taking the wind out of the sails of Turkish nationalists. And I'll give you a left-wing example for the sake of being ecumenical. One can also look at FDR in America, who to a great extent took the wind out of the sails of socialism in America in the 1920s and 30s in delivering the New Deal. Now, many people over in America would say that that was a terrible misstep. But what he did in bringing forward an ambitious political program was to dull the efficacy of those more kind of rambunctious, rabble-rousing populists to his left. In the absence of that kind of figure, I'm afraid that we're in for more discord, more disagreement, probably more violence, etc. So I only hope that our Lee Kuan Yew will come along sooner rather than later.
We've had Mao, Liang Kuan-yu, Caesar, oh my God, Gramsci, lots of dodgy Italians have left and right. But I'm just gonna. We also have FDR, so I'm gonna. I will close things off by making a plea for Theodore Roosevelt, and his taking on of cronyism and dodgy elites. Let's hope we can have one of him. But anyway, thank you so much, Harrison, Sam. Absolute pleasure to have you both on the pod. Great fun, and you know, run out into the sunshine.
Thank you, Sebastian.
Thank you, Sebastian.
Bye, chaps.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.